can be visualized as sitting on another smaller throne. And now on the left of Buddha we have Manjushri, the deity of wisdom, and orange colored wisdom, deity of wisdom. His right hand holding a wisdom sword which he brandishes in the air, and in his with his left hand he holds a wisdom scripture that he holds at heart. So that deity must be visualized again as being very pleased with one in a very youthful appearance and so on. Normally we say that Manjushri holds a wisdom scripture, a scripture pertaining to teachings of wisdom. But the scriptures can change from time to time depending on the texts that you study at the time. Since we are studying Bodhicitta Avatar or the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, so we can visualize Manjushri holding that text. And there is a significance in doing that, especially the author of Guide to Bodhisattva's Way of Life, Shantideva, Shantideva's chief tutor or guru was Manjushri himself. Then, at the front of the Buddha, you can visualize Vajrapani, the deity of power and strength. Now, normally the deity appears to be extremely wrathful having wrathful aspect. But here we should visualize a peaceful Vajrapani with slight tincture of wrath, and such that his right hand is in meditation in the palm of, and with an upright Vajra standing, and then his left hand performing and the wrathful gesture that Gurumbhaji performed, and so that he should be visualized in very peaceful appearance.
Nasa in Jipa. And then I don't know more. No.
So at the back, we visualize Ayatara, the female deity, green Ayatara, and seated in a royal as of ease. It's called the royal ease, with the right leg slightly sort of stretched and the left leg tucked in, and so she has one face, two hands, and so left hand is raised to her heart, with her thumb and the ring finger touching, and the other two fingers standing upright. So this, when she, her, the union of thumb and the ring finger signifies that I achieved enlightenment through the unified practice of method and wisdom. And if we want to achieve enlightenment, we must do so. And when her three upright fingers signify that she is the embodiment of the two jewels. And her right hand stretches outward, and called the gesture is called the mudra of giving. Gap Jin means giving refuge or protection. And whatever we want, we can ask Ayatara to bestow that boon. If you want longevity, we can ask that. And if you want pacification of sicknesses and of various hindrances and obstacles in one's life, we can also ask for pacification of these. And if you want wealth, and you know, Ayatara is said to be a very important deity of wealth too. So all one's wishes can be answered depending on one's sincerity while turning to her.
towards
the friend and towards the friend of the Buddha, towards the friend and the right of the Buddha, slightly Buddha's right knee, so for side, you can visualize Shariputra, Buddha's chief disciple, for known for his wisdom, and on the opposite knee, you can visualize Moggallana. So Shariputra and Moggallana, they hold bhikshu's staff and an alms bowl in their left hands. So the three, the Buddha, Shariputra, and Moggallana, have bhikshu's appearance, because they are bhikshu's, whereas the surrounding deities are not sort of bhikshu's form. They are in the form of deities with the crowns and the jewels and, you know, those ornaments. So that's the visualization we have to do of the Buddha and the five surrounding deities. So the four surrounding deities. Now, you can further do the following visualization. At the heart of the Buddha, you can visualize a small moon disk. In the center of that moon disk, you can visualize the seed syllable of a Buddhist mantra, Mu, the Tibetan word yellow Mu. And you know, yellow Mu, the Tibetan version, or even you can have the English one, M-U, or yellow Mu. And that being surrounded by, on the edge of the moon, by a Buddhist mantra, Om Muni Muni Maha Muni Yasoha, clockwise.
That is
to on the left of the Buddha, on the right of the Buddha, we had Avalokiteshvara in his heart to visualize a small moon disk, and this in the center of that moon disk we visualize white Shri, HRI, RI, or the Tibetan version. And this white slipper Shri should be visualized as being sounded clockwise by Om Mani Padme Hum. Then in at the heart of Manjushri we have the same moon disk in the center of which it stands DHI of the Tibetan script D, and this is and so the crimson or orange colored D surrounded by on the surrounded by Om Vagishari Mo, the mantra of for Manjushri. At the heart of what Vajrapani right in the front of Buddha, you can visualize the same small moon disk in the center of which there is blue hum, H-U-M, on other script, and this should be visualized as being surrounded by Om Vajrapani Hum. At the back of Buddha we had Ayatara, and now likewise she also must be visualized as having a moon disk at her heart, and this in the center of this moon disk there is a blue tam, T-A-M, green tam, not blue, green tam, and being sounded by her mantra Om Dare Dutare Dure Soha. So this visualization is called Dabjur, visualization of the refuge, the objects of sublime beings in whom we call for refuge. Now, facing objects of refuge, then you can visualize yourself right in the center and surrounded by all males, sentient beings, led by your father of the present life, and on your left all female sentient beings led by your mother of this life, and right in front of you you can visualize if you have enemies, then spirits and scapegoats, you know, like people in relation to whom you suffer or you face various crises or problems in life. And at the back of yourself, if you have servants or disciples and so on, you can visualize them at your back. Then all sentient beings must be visualized as in the human form, yet undergoing their respective suffering. So if you were to visualize male and female sentient beings in their original appearance, then it might disturb your visualization and meditation. So it's better and more convenient to see them as to see them in human form. Now, when we say the mantra, Om Mani Mani Maha Muni Soha, the Buddhist mantra, if you visualize that you have started the mantra or the chant, the recitation of the mantra, and then if you feel that all surrounding sentient beings have started reciting the mantra in great resounding pitch, this would have the great benefit in that you would gather as much merit or as many merits as sentient beings you have visualized surrounding you. So I recommend this, to be your daily practice. Say, when you get up early in the morning, and after you have, washed yourself, and if you sit down and then visualize the Buddha and the surrounding deities and the mantras at the six levels mantra at the heart, and then through this visualization of oneself being surrounded by all sentient beings in human form, yet undergoing their respective miseries or sufferings, and then, saying their mantras with a strong desire to call for refuge in oneself and all sentient beings, saying their respective mantras with keen desire to call for refuge in them. So that this can be a very useful and simple practice, as well as after we have visualized the objects of refuge, first, if you could say the seven limb prayers and then say the mantra, or the, in any way, in the other way around too. So let's start this practice today itself by meditating, by visualizing the Buddha and the surrounding deities, and also doing the visualization that one is in the center and being surrounded by all sentient beings in human form. And that's generating great desire to wanting to have to go for refuge in them. Before we recite the mantras of the Buddha and the five and the four surrounding deities, as I've already taught you how to do a visualization of the deities, and now when we say the mantra of Buddha, while leaving aside the four deities, you can focus your attention to the Buddha, or attention on the Buddha, and then imagine that a Buddha emits rays of light from his heart, and the rays of light then falls on one and all sentient, surrounding sentient beings, and these rays of light enter one and all sentient beings through their crown apertures. And then their entire bodies are completely filled or flooded with the strong, brilliant rays of light. And these flooding rays of light, have purified oneself and all ignorant surrounding sentient beings of all negativities committed throughout beginningless time, in particular negativities in terms of disrespect shown to the three jewels.
So,
let's refocus our concentration or attention on the deity on Buddha's right Avalokiteshvara, deity of compassion. And now again we do the same visualization that the deity of compassion emits rays of light from the seeds level tree, white tree, and the sounding mantras at his heart. And this rays of light again fall on 1/7 surrounding sentient beings, and you know, this rays of light, white rays of light, enter 1/7 all sentient beings through their crown apertures. And then again, once we are 1/7 sentient beings completely filled with this brilliant white rays of light, and this again helps, or this again help one and others overcome or purify of all negativities committed over infinite past, in particular negativities concerning selfishness and actions performed selfishness. And with this selfishness, a sense of self-cherishing thought, the biggest obstacle for the development of altruism to achieve enlightenment is removed, then imagine that you have been facilitated by this rays of light towards the development of altruism or bodhicitta.
我们把买的生意推掉了，我们把买的生意直接，你别来我们东南亚吧，汉堡，别来我们台湾吧，汉堡，你别这样子不干活的。反正就是讲这个，其他干别的，我们这个反正生意直接干不了。那等你，我们慢慢的把这生意推，其他地方去外地，等于起码都不卖酒的，起码起码就是一般的，这才是我们这里拿的这些钱就是在肚子里头先。Next,
we focus our attention on the deity for wisdom, Manjushri. And again, at his heart, they visualize the same seed syllables and the mantra that is orange colored D and surrounded by Om Vakishari Mum of that, the mantra of the deity. And these seed syllables and mantras emit rays of light, and these rays of light again fall on the on us sentient beings, and this rays of light, imagine, have entered 1/7 sentient beings through our crown apertures, and then feel that this rays of light in general purify all negativities committed over the beginning of time. Or throughout the beginning of time, and in particular, this rays of light, have removed or dispelled the dark ignorance, the darkness of ignorance, and that is the, you know, the great tragedy for all sentient beings, ignorant sentient beings, is because of their ignorance that they keep on committing negativities or indulging in
negativity.
So cutting short now, and then you know, imagine that you have received a powerful wisdom to be able to gain insight into emptiness. Then next we focus our attention on Vajrapani, who is right in front of the Buddha and from the sixth syllable, Hum, and the sounding mantra Om Vajrapanaham. So this image rest of light, and rest of light enter oneself and all sentient beings through our crown apertures, and then we are totally purified of all negativities, especially hindrances and obstacles in our practice. Like when somebody's doing extremely well in his or her practice, then something always goes wrong somewhere. Either he or she falls sick, or there's a tragedy in the family and so on. That's causing a great hindrance in the person's practice. At the back of the Buddha, we had Ayatara. Now, again, from the heart of Ayatara, the syllable Tam and the surrounding mantra Om Dara Dura Dura Swat. So, image rays of light and rays of light enter one and all sentient beings through our crown apertures, and then purify ourselves of all negativities throughout beginning's time. In particular, imagine this. So these rays of light clear away those negativities responsible for a short life, and imagine that one's longevity or sense of a long life has been increased. And it is said by a great Tibetan master, Gyabjul Hazen Dorjechang, that if you really turn to Ayatara, it's impossible not to have a happy long life. And if you really turn to her and to say her mantra, so we would have, we will have long, prosperous, a happy, virtuous life. Therefore, if we have to turn to her and visualize the rays of light entering one second all sentient beings. Yes. It's not in this class that we have to do this. We can always do this practice of saying the mantra of the five deities and visualizing, doing these visualizations pertaining to them. Although there are hundreds and hundreds of Buddhist deities, but all of them are one or the other emanations of these five deities, and these are the five lords in a way of the various deities which belong necessarily to the five families. So these being the principal lords of the principal deities of those families. So meditation on them suffices, and meditation on all the rest of the deities. Now, as I've explained to you, please say the mantra and do the visualization accordingly. And it's very fortunate that we are able to say these extremely powerful mantras given by Vajradhara, the Tantric deity.
I'm on a baby world.
Yes. Something about law of cause and effect. As the great master Shambhudeva has said, sufferings or miseries from negativities, therefore I should always contemplate and wish as to when I could be free from these bounding negativities. A great Tibetan scholar, practitioner, Nyutri Yatsa Thomas Zambo, one who was one of the greatest, rather the greatest Tibetan Bodhisattva, has said, Buddha has declared that all unbearable sufferings that we sentient beings have to experience in the world existence in general, and in particular the sufferings of the three miserable realms, arise or stem from our own negativities. Therefore, even if it means to sacrifice one's life, I will never perform the same negativities. So one has to contemplate this cause and effect relationship of negativities and sufferings, and thus totally restrain from being negative physically and verbally and mentally. The Buddha has declared on many occasions and addressing the audience, spiritual community, one should between negativities and performing negativities and sacrificing one's life, is that one should sacrifice and restraining, sacrifice one's life at the cost of not performing negativities, because if one were to lose one's life in this way, it's just that a lifetime has come to an end, whereas if one were to perform that negativity, then the results or the consequences are so severe that one would be reborn in one of the two miserable realms of existence, and where let alone actually experiencing any kind of pleasure and happiness, one won't even hear the word pleasure and happiness. So this is what the Buddha has said, and the Buddha, whatever he has said or whatever he has taught, he has taught out of a perfect understanding of situations and out of a profound affection and compassion, and Therefore, it's worth believing in what he has said and acting accordingly. We can trust the Buddha's teachings and regard them as valid teachings because the validity of Buddha as being a perfect person has been established by great Indian logicians, Buddhist logicians like Acharya Thich Nhat and Acharya Dharmakirti. If one were to study these works, of the works of Thich Nhat and Dharmakirti, it is impossible for the intelligent not to believe in their logic concerning the validity or concerning the fact that Buddha is a valid person, therefore all teachings valid. So they have really applied very strong cogent logic in proving this fact that Buddha is a valid, non-fraudulent, perfect being. One of the opening lines of Tamo Namtul Paramana Vedika, it's a compendium of, it's a treatise on Buddhist logic. So, so this is
the...
compassion. Compassion is the source. compassion is the proof, the ultimate proof for the validity of the Buddha, or the, for the fact that Buddha is a valid person. and although there are many reasons advanced towards this fact, but the ultimate reason which goes to prove that Buddha is a valid, non-fraudulent, perfect being is his overflowing compassion, overwhelming compassion. And that's because when Buddha generated the wish to achieve enlightenment, bodhicitta, so he generated that in order to free suffering sentient beings from worldly existence, and motivated by that overwhelming mind of enlightenment, then he struggled along the path to path towards enlightenment through over three great periods of countless, great countless eons, and in terms of really sacrificing all that he possessed in order to earn merit necessary for achievement of enlightenment, like sometimes giving away his parts of his body. At other times, when he was when he had been reborn as king, then he gave away his kingdom, his queen, his princes and princesses, and so all these selfless practices were done as Bodhisattva before he achieved enlightenment. And doing so, doing these practices over a long period of three great countless eons, he finally evolved into perfect enlightened being. Therefore, would he then deceive and sentient beings give false statements about things, give false teachings. It's impossible because when he generated mind of enlightenment, he generated for the sentient beings, and when he struggled for the when he struggled along the path, he did so entirely for the sake of sentient beings, which would then be, you know, silly enough to really cheat, go against his basic principle of compassion. So that is the compassion is in this way the strongest reason to prove the validity of a Buddha as a perfect being. It's because of this, many works written by great scholars and practitioners, in those works you'll find Tupe Sung declared by the Buddha or the Muni, or the able one. So they have gained valid conviction in the Buddha's teaching, and they have examined the teachings of Buddha and gained a valid conviction concerning those teachings. Therefore, they take Buddha's word as in the final proof, proof for various teachings that they, proof for the validity of various teachings that they have given. Great teachers like Nagarjuna and Shantideva and also many other panditas, highly accomplished scholars, so they ultimately take refuge in Buddha and saying by saying declared by the Buddha, so they take Buddha's word as the final statement concerning the teachings. Therefore, this morning we will practice meditation. We will do meditation on the Buddha. In fact, it would be nice if you could visualize the Buddha in the center and the false surrounding deities. If you find it hard to handle, you know, all of them in your meditation on them, so you can simply meditate first on the Buddha, and when that meditation improves, then you can try to include in that, within that meditation others are sounding deities. The great master Shantideva has given this following piece of advice. He has given this advice or instruction out of great concern or compassion for us. He has said, if we have to be extremely careful while walking on the edge of ordinary epics, ordinary the edge of an epics or a cliff which is not that serious or not that deep, if we have to be extremely careful that we should not fall down, and not only that, we even don't dare to go to the edge itself, feeling that we are for fear of or feeling giddy and thus falling into the abyss. So if we have to be so careful with regard to such a minor or secondary edge of the cliff. So this is an example he has given first. That we have to be all the more careful and be cautious and not to fall into the abyss of the two, the yawning abyss, the two lower realms, so which, you know, the depth of which is almost unknown, also thousands and thousands of lakes down beneath the earth. And we should take every care that we don't fall into that abyss. Because if we were to fall into that abyss once, then it is as though there's no hope for us to come out of that. The only way we have to is to refrain from indulging in negative actions and then apply ourselves to positive actions. His father said, when the patient is suffering from ailments like disturbance in the elements, suffering from phlegm, jaundice, and disturbance in the winds, or in energy in his body, or suffering from tuberculosis and other physical illnesses, the patient has to be extremely obedient to the doctor's advice and instruction, and the patient must eat those things that he has been advised, and avoid eating and drinking anything that is detrimental to his health or to her health. Besides that, he or she has to observe certain lifestyles during the time of illness. So if the patient has to be absolutely obedient and follow the doctor's advice or instruction. As compared to this illness, this conventional illness, the illness that we have, that all suffering beings, all beings in the world existence have, is far greater and far more serious, because it is illness of the two poisons of mind, of passion, hatred, and ignorance, which have been afflicting sentient beings throughout beginningless time. Just as the normal conventional patient has to follow doctor's advice and instruction, so do patients suffering sentient beings suffering from these three poisons of mind must follow the instructions of the doctor Buddha himself.
Hey.
내셔지 좀 내셔지 좀 맞을 바 나도 내 싸워지 조금 아래 자금 좀 보고 맞을 바 나도 내 싸워지 조금 아래 아우르지 작으나 그 내 여래 내래 그 내래 영원히
For us to recover from to get some respite and finally recover from our illnesses of desire, hatred and ignorance, it's important that, or it's very imperative we follow the instructions of our doctor, our spiritual doctor, the Buddha. And if we were to follow his instruction, we will be certainly victorious over, and we will certainly overcome all these illnesses for once and all, and never to be relapsed. Whereas it is stated in the medical texts that all our sicknesses are ultimately rooted within, rooted in our own attitudes, or in our own mind, way of thinking. So all our sicknesses are rooted in desire, passion, hatred and ignorance. Until we eliminate or get rid of these very roots of all forms of various physical illnesses, we won't recover from from major physical illnesses. Until we achieve the state of fortis toy or arhatship, it's impossible for sentient beings to be free from any kind of sicknesses. When the element of passion and desire is predominant, the person tends to suffer from what we call film, and begging is the Tibetan word. And when the person has hatred predominantly present, working in his system or in terms of mind, then that gives that causes blood pressure, attention, and so on. Especially when you study Tantra, Buddha has explained in great detail how our bodies are formed, and our the source, the material source of our bodies, and what are the constituents of our bodies, like different channels, then fine network of channels, the nerves in our bodies, and what flows in this in these channels, and what are the principal channels, and so on. So the functions of each of the channels, the functions of the energy that flows in them, and what causes sicknesses, and what are the methods to recover from sicknesses, and especially how to take advantage of the energy, how to energy that flows in these various channels, and transform this energy as a method of achieving enlightenment. If you were to study Tantra, you will gain a sound understanding of a human body, and especially channels and energies and drops, which are very important a basis of Tantric practice.
Mm-hmm.
Thus, he says, Shantideva says, it's the Buddha's spiritual teachings, medicine-like spiritual teachings, which will uproot all forms of mental and physical agonies. And so who else, unless the person is so stupid, who else will not follow the instructions, the prescriptions of the Buddha? So what really holds us from falling into the three lower realms is our own activities that we perform in our daily life, and our activities, whether they are going to be positive virtuous actions or negative non-virtuous actions, will depend on the motivation, on the basis of which those actions are performed. Therefore, so we have to be our own saviors. So we are our own saviors. So we, as saviors of ourselves, have to perform causal virtuous actions based on some women's, altruistic minds, or kind-heartedness, and then any actions performed, any speech, anything said, will become virtuous actions, and one doesn't have to depend or turn to anybody if one is virtuous in one's daily life. On the other hand, if one is being negative all the time, day in and day out, and negative thoughts, negative actions, and then these are very causes of rebirth in the three lower realms, and when these actions are performed and left uncleared or unpurified, then if one were to turn to any sublime being, it will be rather impossible for anyone to help help one. If we were to explain virtues and non-virtues, in non-technical terms, virtues are those actions which bring happiness in the future, and non-virtues, the negative actions, are those which bring or which cause miseries, unhappiness in the future. This house itself, itself has become, Chaitanya means a stupa, because in there, there is the precious statue of the Buddha, and of course other scriptures and so on, and therefore the moment one enters this room and in this house, and especially this room, so one is influenced positively, and if anyone were to consciously or unconsciously go around the house, so that would also constitute a virtuous practice indeed. Buddha Gaya is a holy place for Buddhists, and thousands and thousands of Buddhists go to places like Buddha Gaya and so on. And so why have these places become holy? It's because Buddha once lived there and gave those courses. And Buddha has said that there's no difference between making offerings and doing virtuous practices with regard to himself and his representations or objects on statues. Therefore, if going to holy places in India are virtuous, then why not entering this room and going around this house a virtuous practice? It's not only that particular statue in that display case, but there are other objects as well. Because at that point when Buddha was passing into Nirvana, people doubted whether they would have anyone to seek guidance, spiritual guidance. Buddha declared that there will be no difference seeing Buddha himself alive and seeing his statues in the future and doing and making offerings to Buddha, to the living Buddha, and making offerings to the statues of the Buddha. He has said there will be no difference in terms of merit gathered by the person. When the teachings of the Buddha, when the doctrine of the Buddha will completely come to an end, then the statues and scriptures will completely, God will become non-existent. So statues will disappear and scriptures will be only pages, empty pages, and nothing, scripts in them. So this clearly shows that, just as Buddha has himself declared, that his statues, his objects of representation are Buddha's own emanations. Not different. In Lhasa is the famous statue of the Buddha in the central cathedral, and that is regarded as the holiest statues statue. So much so that people from northeastern Tibet, Amto, even from Mongolia, make a year-long journey towards Lhasa, and only to be able to see that statue. And except that statue was consecrated and blessed by Buddha himself. Otherwise, there is no difference in terms of holiness of all the statues of the Buddha. Therefore, what I'm trying to say is, even if one were to come to this room and sit and meditate and in front of the Buddha, is indeed a fortunate thing to do. While these advantages are available and at our disposal, it's very important that we take advantage of these. And it's very, the fact that there's a center in Dunedin gives chance for interested people to come to this center and express their religious feelings or aspirations by undertaking various practices.
Mm-hmm.
Many lamas have established various centers in all of the world, and I've been to those centers during my 82 world tour, and I've seen significance of those centers. And like in Sydney, there are few centers, and in fact, in Australia itself, and I've seen how these centers are extremely useful and beneficial for Buddhists there. Whereas big cities, which don't have such centers, although there might be people interested to do a various practice, because there is no platform or sort of a center to go to, then people have to be satisfied with their simple lot and not be able to fully express or fully practice teachings. And I've said sometime before that this is the only center in Dunedin, and it's in a way a history making center in Dunedin. And so while the center is there for people to go to and study and practice, it's very important that people take advantage of these. And otherwise, it will be difficult to have such advantages. In America, most most universities in the world, in the Western world, are offering courses in Buddhist teachings. And this shows the highlight and the importance of the popularity of Buddhism has gained in the world. And we are studying here the teachings of the Buddha himself. Unlike lectures that students receive in the various universities in Buddhism, and then lectures that we receive have I think somewhat a greater significance, because we have the transmissions, unbroken transmissions of the teachings, whereas lectures in universities, I don't mean all of them, but few of them have only studied from the books, by merely studying from the books, although one may gain an understanding, thorough understanding or partial understanding of the teachings, but still some an important element, an important element of unbroken transmission of the lineage is missing. Therefore, it will have an impact on the students.
너희 대체 많이 누가 선전 일치기는 시행해도 계속 생각하고 나도 대화 있는 사람들이라 뭐보다 일치기는 뭐지 시행 편내지 말이 시행에 뭐가 그런 연속이 속이 그런 연인가 아니 배 그런 배 손이던 이거 수는 다시 뭐 보여서 너무 연해서 강한지 그래서 되게 용안들이 영어식 시험이 이런 것들아 이런 사람들이 좋다가 또 이거 칩다 이거 좀 칩 많이 돼
Buddhist teachings are to be given by the teachers you know, who practice. Teachers who practice, who have studied more and practice more than students on, and then the taught. And otherwise, they are in the world, even among the you know, Tibetan teachers around the world. There are a few of them you know, who have not studied that thoroughly enough. Who only teach but no practice. So if one were to only teach no practice, then it's going to have a very little efficacy on the students or on the taught. Because the teacher has to set a fine example of for those teachings. And by living his life by those teachings in daily life, so that students can look up to for inspiration. Otherwise, the people are. Incur a lot of expenses inviting teachers from different parts of the world, and you know, they give a lecture for a week or for a fortnight or at the most or a month, and then they go back and students don't see them and what they actually do in their daily life wherever they live. So from what I've talked to you, please you can keep in mind what you think is what appeals to you and what you think is reasonable, and things that sound unreasonable then you can forget. So things that you think are reasonable and worth keeping in mind, and thus you know, giving due thoughts on them, so you can try to keep in mind. And now for this morning's meditation practice, we will continue from last week's, and that's meditation on Sangye Chomden De, means Buddha Shakyamuni. And we will meditate on him, visualizing him on top of our heads. And each meditation on him is said to have a great significance of being able to see in the future lifetimes many Buddhas and many living Buddhas and receive teachings directly from them. And while we try to meditate on him, we are able to, Gurmukhi says, this meditation purifies ourselves of various negativities. So the benefits of meditating on the Buddha are immense. We should practice the teachings as you know, the Holy Lamas or the Holy Gurus have given. And because the teachings are the real facts, and it's the way we live our lives and the way we think in the negative way. Therefore, in order to correct our way of life, So we should follow the instructions. Kundan Tamjai Kempa is one of the masters that I will cite, and he is a great scholar at the same time, a great master, great practitioner, or one who was not different from any of the Indian great Indian masters of the ancient times. He has said this entire life is hindered by negative activities that we perform. So this entire life is wasted in looking after one's close friends and relations, not out of true love, but out of attachment to one, because the fact that they are related to one and one's attachment to oneself and then to them, one looks after them, and then in performing negativities or performing actions in order to get rid of or eliminate people who are hostile to one and hostile to one's relations. So one's entire lifespan is wasted in doing these frivolous activities. Although one spends or uses one's life, the duration of one's life in doing these, insubstantial or meaningless, pointless activities, however, one won't be able to complete these, because all of a sudden, one will leave this. One will have to leave this world without things, completed, and carrying the load of negativities. Then one will go to the next life. After one has left this world, so one will be following a completely unknown and a strange path. When one reaches the intermediate stage, so one won't have any knowledge of the path one is following, and at the same time, then one will see that one is completely surrounded by the hell sanctuaries, the sanctuaries of the henchmen of a Yama, Lord of Death, and as a result, seeing no escape from them, one will suffer a lot, and also one will foresee the ensuing intense suffering, and that is the time when one realizes that one's activities to look after one's relations and to get rid of or to eliminate one's enemies while one was alive was totally meaningless or was of no use, and one's activities were of no use at all. One realized that they were entirely meaningless, and that realization comes when things are too late. Or when it's too late, then such a realization will dawn on one, and one will be filled with the gyoba, great or intense regret, and that's too late to feel regretful about one's negativities. Now, Lamkimeg is Sakin Chu, it means Dharma, or the teachings are the only gods which will guide when you make a journey on the unknown path. Dharma or the teachings are the only provision that you can fall back on, you know, on your sort of long distance journeys. Since Dharma or the teachings are the, you know, your captain or your escort, or, you know, the person you can rely on while you pass through, you know, most dangerous and deceptive tracks, or sort of when you make most deceptive journeys. Because of this, now I will apply my three doors of body and body, speech and mind to two adjustments, to Dharma and to the teachings. Now is the time when we have freedom and liberty, and, you know, we have opportunity to do what we would like to do, and what at the moment freedom is in our court, so to say. If we cannot achieve some sense of, you know, a definite security which on which we can rely on in future lifetimes, or definite security for in all the future lifetimes, at this time when we have freedom and opportunity to do so. If we do not do it at this time when we are free and when we have all, you know, the chances, the golden chance to do that, and it will be too late when this breath stops for good, and where one is helpless and completely at the mercy of other circumstances. He also says, when, you know, we have to, when we have to leave our bodies, which have been accompanying us since conception in the mother's womb, in our cold death bed, and, you know, when we have to leave this body in our death bed, so there's no need to mention that we will have to leave behind everything in terms of wealth, relations, power, authority. Let alone you know, being able to take one's body, one's wealth, one's power, one's position in society, and so on. Let alone taking these, one won't be able to look behind, look at them, and, you know, one won't get that chance. Considering these realities concerning life and death and lives after death, if you really think, if you really come to realize that you really have to, you really need to practice teachings.
Mm.
And in this way, when your mind has, you know, from its very core, started turning to, or sincerely started turning to the teachings, and then, as for the teachings, there are many high-sounding teachings. And it says, although there are, you know, many teachings, some are very profound, others are vast, and thus high-sounding teachings, but nothing so effective and so useful as the teachings presented in the texts written by Jhampo Lama Tsongkhapa called the graduated path to enlightenment, teachings which have which contain the ultimate essence of all instructions that come from Adisha down to the writer himself. So it's a Lamrim, or the graduated path enlightenment, are the teachings in which the nature of entire sutra and teachings of sutra and tantra are presented in their precise order, number, and at the same time extremely clear for one to practice. Not that teachings are explained at a disorderly manner. Teachings are presented in such a manner that one is one can practice started one can start practicing right at the time of studying the texts. And therefore, let alone practicing the teachings presented in a most orderly and a practical manner, let alone practicing them, even if we could try to form an understanding of a comprehension of the teachings and the presentation of the teachings, starting from the first path, initial practice of development of devotion and respect to the Guru, up to the final attainment of enlightenment, if we could form a general understanding and comprehension of the presentation of the teachings, even that can be extremely useful and meaningful. If one could, then one might turn to the, you know, the great, the extensive text entitled The Graduated Path Enlightenment, if not the middle one, if not, then, you know, short, yet containing other concise text written by Jhampo Lama Tsongkhapa called Yuan Ding Xi Yuma, the basis of all quality, is just the starting line, opening lines of the that text as Yuan Ding Xi Yuma. If one could read those read that text. Also, Lama Chöpa Guru Puja has the presentation of the entire part. So if one could do what we call scanning meditation of the teaching, starting from devotion to the Guru, development, devotion, respect, and good rapport with the Guru, down to the up to the achievement of enlightenment, the teaching and the topics are presented in the order of practice and in the order of realization. Therefore, it can be extremely useful, and it will be like scanning meditation is like going to the top of a hill and then enjoying the vast panoramic view, having a general scan of the area below that one overlooks. In the same way, one does not just simply remain fixed on one topic during scanning meditation. One just starts analyzing, or rather starts looking at the entire path from the initial path of the practice of devotion to the Guru to the practice which finally helps one achieve enlightenment.
因为你过来是带我，我们两年多上的，我已经有些了，那么人就办的快也不巧，那没办法。If
one is really interested in our teachings, and their practice is first of all important to form bhava, means understanding or comprehension of the teachings presented in order of their practice and the development of realizations out of those practices, starting from the first practice, which can also be called the first part of development, devotion to the Guru, up to the practice of development of union of clear light and illustrated body. In this, one doesn't necessarily need to know every detail of each topic presented in such order, even if one is able to form a rough comprehension. Even that itself is capable of helping one achieve enlightenment. Means ignorance, or if one doesn't know the other topics related, then that total comprehension of that particular topic alone one wouldn't have one achieve enlightenment. So it's like if you have 100 shirts but no trousers, then you won't be able to go outside, would you? Likewise, if one has 100 pair of pants or trousers but no shirt, no upper garments, it would be very awkward to go all the time bare chested. However, if one has, a decent attachment, means even, a bad pair of trousers and, a broken shirt, then, one can appear in the town in those clothes. So one can manage. Likewise, if one could form, if not a detailed understanding of the entire part of Sutta and Tantra, but at least a rough, a general, a broad idea of the entire part, then that will help one, or you can manage achievement of enlightenment by practice of practicing those rough understandings.
And
And one can do the fine tuning later on when one has perfected the first initial practices for the arm formed based on one's general understanding. Therefore, Kadampa masters have said it's much more preferable to form a rough understanding of a graduated past enlightenment than to gain direct extrasensory perception, psychic feats, and other realizations, other mundane realizations, because they said we did gain such extrasensory perceptions, psychic feats, and miraculous powers in our past lives, but these didn't help us turn our back on the world existence for good. Instead, if we had formed at least a general and broad understanding of the order of graduated past enlightenment, that would have helped us by this time abandon world existence. By doing such a sharp scanning contemplation or meditation of the entire part presented in a graded form, one should try to gain an understanding of the entire part, and then try to make one's human life, which we gained only this time, meaningful. Doing so, and one should say that one doesn't have to regret at the time of death that you couldn't do better, and or that I could have done a bit better than, or I could have used my life in a virtuous practice. So one should say that one doesn't have to feel sad and regretful at the point of death. So one should die with a happy conscience. Saying to oneself that I did my best, and I live now the result to my best efforts. So now one should do something about one's future right now, so that one doesn't have to fear the death and be ignorant of one's future life and so on. Now, at this time, we will practice meditation on the Buddha, and while we practice a meditation on the Buddha, or contemplation on the Buddha, it is as always. The deity that we try to concentrate on must be seen as being a reflection of one's guru in an aspect of that deity, and that is the key to success of a meditation or the accomplishment of a concentration. And before we visualize the Buddha, we can offer three cushions question of lotus, question of moon and the sun, one atop the other, and these three things, these three questions signify signify the three principal parts of our renunciation, renunciation, emptiness, and wisdom and method, wisdom and enlightenment. Also, in tantric context, they signify clear light, illusory body, and the union of clear light and illusory body. And so on top of these three questions, then one has to visualize the Buddha. And if you can practice this now, it will be useful, because I'm teaching you Shinne mental questions to be choose always for many reasons. We choose Buddha as the topic of mental questions or object of meditation. In the beginning, we won't have a clear image, appearance of the Buddha to our mind's eye, and we will only have a vague, yellowish appearance, and we should be satisfied with that. And if we concentrate on that vague, yellowish appearance, and that with that we will be able to achieve nature, means stability of mind on that vague appearance. When the stability is accomplished, then one can work on the clarity later on. No. When we practice mental questions, shinne or calm abiding of the mind on the chosen object, then it is always important to, as far as possible, to maintain correct physical postures, like you're sitting in a Vajra cross-legged and so on. If not Vajra cross-legged or lotus position, then you can simply sit in a cross-legged position. If not, then you can sit in the way Green Tower sits. That's called the royal ease. Please start this meditation also telling that whatever I've told you this morning, I've read from a small text from Gundam Rinpoche, so it is his advice that I have given to you. Mention not the future Buddha or the fifth Buddha who will manifest in the world as a supreme Nimanakaya or supreme emanated Buddha from his pure abode, and will turn the wheel of Dharma, just as the present historical Buddha has done, who at the moment, Mahajanat, who at the moment is giving teachings in the joyous land, Garden Yigachansen, in the God Jam, Now, he has said, like our jewel and the space, meaning our mind, the ultimate essence, the ultimate nature of our mind is serpency, clear luminosity cognizing. So the luminous and cognitive aspect, nature of the mind, has never been polluted by altered by temporary failing factors like desire, hatred, ignorance, jealousy, and so on. The ultimate nature of the mind is luminous and quite apprehending by nature, or the power of having the power of knowing things. He has given three examples to show this luminous and cognitive nature of the ultimate nature of the mind. Rinchen, the precious jewel, but not so much jewel as the precious metal gold. Although gold from outside might be covered with dust and stains, but inside the gold is ever pure, and nothing has the covering. Dust and stains have not got inside the core of gold, and thus changed the metallic property of gold. The metallic property of gold is 100% pure and always pure. In the same way, our minds are by nature luminous and has the power of knowing things, and this aspect of the mind has never been at any time altered, except that this has been covered, never has been altered by delusions like attachment, desire, hatred, ignorance, and so on. Like the space, our mind is clear and has the power of knowing. If the space by nature is empty, or empty and without without the clouds. The clouds that overcast the space or the sky are not the intrinsic nature and the part of the space. Space intrinsically is without any obscuring factors. If clouds were inseparable qualities and parts of the space, then there would never be a time when we could see a clear sky or space. However, we know that the clouds are drifted by the wind, and the sky or the space becomes quite clear. In the same way, our minds are not intrinsically tainted by various negative thoughts that arise and obscure our mind. Apart from obscuring these negative thoughts, are not the intrinsic and inseparable qualities of our minds. If one were to think about these examples, and then also relate the examples to one's mind, and how the mind is really free of such ultimately the mind is free of such obscure things. Like the water is the third example, the ultimate nature of water is clarity and purity, being clear and pure. However, when temporary contaminants like mud and clay and water, and then water is stirred, the water becomes unclear and muddy, and the water is the clarity of water is obscured. But if that water is left to itself for the dust particles to settle at the bottom, the water once again becomes clear. This shows that particles have not got inside, have ultimately changed the nature of the water and made it quite unclean and muddy, because the water does become clear and pure. In the same way, the negative thoughts like desire, hatred, ignorance, jealousy, and so on have only temporarily or adventitiously covered and obscured the clarity and the aware nature of cognitive nature of our mind. So these negative thoughts are only adventitious veiling factors of the mind. The mind intrinsically, as said earlier on, is always luminous, powerful, power of reflecting things in their own image, and thus knowing things well. Jidun Jamgon Machena, the future Buddha, work, one of the works authored by him is called Gyulama Utra Tantra, the supreme or the peerless tantra. So it's a very important work for Buddhists because it deals with this aspect of the mind and how, therefore, every sentient being can achieve the state of enlightenment, because the temporary defilements can be separated totally through the application of antidotes to them, and the mind becomes enlightened. The ultimate quality of a mind, that is being luminous and aware, or being or having the power of cognizing things, is the quality of the subtle mind that we have, the subtle mind which which mounts on the subtle body. Now, at the moment, we have body and mind, and the body is of two types, gross body and the subtle body. Mind is also two types, gross mind and subtle mind. Gross body and gross mind, which came into being at the conception and which have developed and evolved over a period of time in this life, do come to an end when this body dies, or when this life comes to an end. However, the subtle mind and the subtle body are never inseparable. They are there, they have been accompanying us throughout beginningless time. Subtle body refers to the subtle energy of the wind, which serves as the mount for the subtle mind. And these are inseparable and two aspects of the two or one reality. Now, as we decondition our minds by applying antidotes and thus keep on removing the layers of obscurities through constant practice, so deep sum in the core is a luminous mind. And as we keep on removing and deconditioning the the mind, and removing obscurities, and the layers become thinner and thinner, and as the layers become thinner and thinner, so are removed, then the luminosity and the cognitive power of the mind becomes clear, more and more clear, and when the obscurities are totally cleared away, the mind, the subtle mind, will become manifest, and at that time the mind would have an achieved enlightenment. But the person who has that mind would have achieved enlightenment. So this subtle mind and subtle body are called the Buddha nature, because it is this mind and this wind which have been accompanying us throughout beginning's time and will accompany us up to the state of enlightenment. Therefore, these two are called Buddha nature, because these have the power of transforming into Buddha's mind and Buddha's omniscient mind and the glorious body.
We also know that Buddha
So what we have failed so far is we have failed to discover that we have the ultimate essence or the seed, which is called the Buddha nature, to become ourselves fully enlightened Buddhas. And because of this failure, we have suffered all this time. And now an example is given here. So just as if a person who lives in poverty suffers from poverty, so in his house, underneath in his house, if there are precious jewels, so if although there are precious jewels underneath his house, the jewels won't speak up and say, "Here we are, and exploit us and take us out and remove your poverty." The poor person who has no power of knowing such and discovering such thing won't know that, and he spends his life in poverty. However, a person with extrasensory perception or the visual clairvoyance comes to him and tells him that how underneath his house there are jewels, and if you were to untap those or discover and dig them out and then make use of them, he will be able to remove his poverty and live in comfort and luxury. And in the same way, if he would be able to do so, in the same way, up to now we have not been able to discover, this power, the potential nature of becoming Buddhas ourselves. As a result, we have suffered by lacking happiness all this time, and we have been bombarded with sufferings of different kinds, and thus we have failed to discover this nature. Now, Buddha, like the one with clairvoyance, has explained in the scriptures that you are yourself quite capable of achieving Buddhahood, because you have this ultimate nature or the seed potential to become Buddhas, because you have two such seeds called the natural abiding Buddha nature and the developing Buddha nature. Because of these two natures or potential seeds, or the potent seeds, so you can certainly become Buddha yourself. All that you need to do is to untap and exploit what you have got. So we have all the means, powerful means, the potent means to be Buddhas ourselves. It's just that we have not been able to know this well enough, and thus make most of what we have. From this we can understand that we don't need to suffer all the time in the future. If you want, we can be totally free. We can achieve a state which is totally, literally totally free from all kinds of physical and mental miseries or agonies or sufferings. In view of this, keeping this fact in mind, Acharya Dhammakirti, the great Buddhist logician, has said, all sufferings that we experience are not permanent aspects of our life, because they have adverse or counteracting antidotes, or Nyojitoptim is powerful antidotes to them. Because there are powerful antidotes to them, so we can totally, uproot or get rid of our sufferings. What he is trying to get at is all our sufferings have stemmed from our own ignorance of not being able to understand how things actually exist. Because of this misconception of the ultimate existence of things, we have projected various thoughts and cause various sufferings to our own misconception, and That misconception, because it's a wrong attitude, a wrong thought, a misconception, and it says it can be corrected, there are powerful antidotes to correct that. And that antidote is the wisdom, the powerful antidote, or the wisdom of understanding emptiness of inherent existence. Just as if the barley seeds or the rice seeds do not, although the seeds have the power to produce sprouts and shoots, but if the seeds do not meet with the necessary condition and thus get rotten, then the productive power of seed is totally sapped. As a result, the seed would be there physically, but won't be able to produce any shoots or sprouts. Similarly, if we could affect ignorance. If we could affect ignorance by applying the antidote of wisdom, understanding, and emptiness, then that ignorance, which has been so far very powerful, will become impotent and won't be able to produce any sufferings. When ignorance is sapped and totally weakened and dispelled. Or in other words, when ignorance comes to an end, all sufferings due to ignorance will also come to an end. So, with this note, that all sufferings are certainly and definitely eliminable through application of the right antidote. So, we'll stop here for the time being, and let's practice our Sunday meditation. I've already told you how to visualize the Buddha and what one has to do while practicing meditation on the Buddha, or simply pointed concentration on the Buddha. So try to concentrate, first clap, try to visualize, and then you simply pointedly concentrate on him. How should we go about practicing the teachings? By practice of teachings, it's not that one does something for a few days and then one wishes or one hopes that all of a sudden illuminating realization dawns on one all of a sudden. It's not that way. What one has to do is a very slow and steady process over many lifetimes, during which every day one must try to get rid of or eliminate one fault, one negative thought, and as a result, one negative form of speech and negative action. And instead, or on the other hand, one should try to cultivate single virtues of body, speech, and mind. And by doing this constantly over many lifetimes, so one evolves ultimately into a perfect Buddhahood, or one evolves into a perfect Buddha, so where all qualities are fully accomplished and all sufferings have come to an end. So it's only by doing so over many lifetimes that one attains the state of Buddhahood, not all of a sudden.
我们在这里面，修道里面，那个灵光一时，灵光一时呢，都升起的，啊，升起的，这这这，它也就这样子的。
We can practice Dharma or teachings in two ways: through our body, through our spirit and mind. The best way of practicing Dharma or teachings is to practice the teachings mentally, or we should give a stress on the mental practice of the teachings rather than, you know, on body and speech. The reason why we have to give greater importance to mental practice is that our actions of body and speech are motivated or influenced by our minds. Depending on the kind of motivation, the motivating mind, our actions of body and speech become virtues and all known virtues. And in order to overcome negative deeds, a negative action of body and speech, one has to first get rid of negative motivating thought or mind. Therefore, we have so many at the moment, at the present time, so many negative attitudes, negative thoughts. But as we told you last week, that these negative thoughts, negative attitudes, are not intrinsic nature of our minds. You remember that I told you the intrinsic nature of mind is luminosity and luminosity or luminous, and, you know, being able to cognize or apprehend things. Negative thoughts that seem to contaminate our minds at the moment have not, you know, altered the intrinsic clear and cognitive nature of our minds. Therefore, the minds, our minds can be totally separated from these negative thoughts. And the way we separate our minds from these negative thoughts is, as I told you at the beginning of this talk, by slow and steady practice of trying to eliminate one negative thought a day and cultivate a positive thought instead. And in this slow and steady process, then one is able to shed the negative thoughts and bring into manifest the luminous nature of mind, and It's when they have been successful in shedding or in clearing our negativities, the obscure negativities, then the mind becomes clear, absolutely clear, luminous, and it gains, it gains its full power of recognizing things. I gave you the example of the sky and clouds. Clouds, although may temporarily overcast the sky, but the clouds are not the permanent and intrinsic parts of a sky. If it was so, then the sky would go totally and permanent overcast, and we would never be able to see the sun. But that's not been the case. The sky becomes clear and clear and bright. In the same way, we can also deal with the mind. Sim means mind, Sari means clear, Rig means aware, nature of mind. So this Sim Sari Gacha, the aspect of mind being luminous and cognizing, or the power of having cognition. So these are inseparable qualities, ultimate qualities of mind, and these are valid qualities of mind. Whereas negative obscuring mind thoughts, although they tend to condition us so badly, but these are base. These are based on flimsy, mistaken grounds, because they are based on the wrong or mistaken grounds. Through the application of empty thoughts, what is based on falsehood and wrong ground can be effectively cleared away and removed through a proper application of empty thoughts. So just as there can be two I consciousnesses, one which perceives the white snow mountain as the white snow mountain, and one some people who have some defect in their organs tend to see the white snow mountain as the blue snow mountain. Although there are two perceptions, the one the I consciousness which sees the white snow mountain as blue is a mistaken concept, a mistaken consciousness. So it can, it's a wrong concept or wrong consciousness. So it can be corrected. Whereas the I consciousness will see the white as white snow mountain. So it's just a valid nature of a white mountain. So it doesn't, it doesn't need to be corrected, because it's a valid thing and it's a correct perception. From a mistaken concept of a mistaken attitudes that we have at the moment. Therefore, we needn't suffer for all times to come or for eternity, because the source of suffering, their negative thoughts, are themselves based on falsehood, an incorrect base. Therefore, if only we know how to, if only we know the incorrect nature of negative thoughts, and then be able to apply proper remedial antidotes to overcome or to correct the incorrectness, the wrong attitudes that we have, then all our sufferings would come to end. Our sufferings at the moment are caused by desire, hatred, jealousy, and these are negative thoughts. Negative thoughts, as I told you before, are based as false and as wrong as the conception, as the eye consciousness of seeing the what's now as the blue snow mountain. So this can be corrupted. There's room for redemption and, you know, great scope for total freedom. Although we all seek and we long for peace and happiness in life after life, but we are temporarily badly conditioned by mistaken thoughts that arise in our minds, like attachment, hatred, and jealousy. And these are called negative thoughts, because the moment they arise, they crop up in our minds, if not the real peace of mind, even our neutral state of mind is totally ruffled and disturbed. And when we have a desire, so we get agitated and restless, and we have hatred and jealousy, then the real peace of mind, or even the neutral state of mind, is totally, disrupted, and we suffer while these arise in our minds, and then these further motivate us to to do actions which are themselves cause for further and future sufferings. The great master Shantideva has said, in fact, delusions are not, very powerful, strong things. Delusions don't have strong arms, strong legs, muscles to, overpower us physically. Nor are they some women, they are not intelligent or clever, crafty things, and nor are they heroes and brave things. And in fact, delusions are themselves quite weak and feeble. But the tragedy is that we have been overpowered by such delusions, which are themselves such weak by nature. Only thing that we need to do is whenever we suffer from negative thoughts, or when negative thoughts arise in the mind, all that we have to understand is or do is to apply antidotes. And it's said that if we apply the correct counteracting thought or the antidote, no delusion remains unchallenged, so they are overpowered by the proper antidote.
Nemo,
Between cutting, you know, a tree, felling a tree, and you know, abandoning or destroying a negative thought. In fact, it's much easier to overcome or to destroy a negative thought, because in felling a tree or chopping a wood, or what you need in the first place many things like the axe, the saw, and so on. Besides that, you must have very strong arms and strong shoulders, and then you have to do a lot of physical work. Whereas in cutting through negative thoughts, one doesn't need all these. All that one needs to do is a proper meditation in which one is able to see things exactly the opposite way as the delusion of the negative thought says. If you develop that, if you develop that skill of seeing things exactly the opposite way the delusion or negative thought sees, there you have overcome. There you have seen the reality of the object and then overcome that negative thought. Whereas in this other example is, in order to destroy the conventional worldly enemies, you know, they are very hard to overcome. There are so many of them, and you need so many weapons. And if need be, you know, you're also going to have deadly weapons to destroy enemies on a large scale. But with respect to delusion, the enemies of delusions, all that you need to develop correct a valid perception, which is able to see the things exactly the opposite way as the negative thought sees. When you see a scarecrow in the distance or an effigy of human form, and when you, from the distance, at the first look, you would think there's a human there standing, and this perception, this understanding of the effigy as a real human being is a wrong perception or wrong understanding. And now, in order to overcome or remove this wrong perception or understanding, what you need to do is, if you to getting nearer object of the effigy or the scarecrow, if you see, if you develop an understanding that the effigy is not a human being, so this understanding. This understanding of the effigy as a non-human so removes from one's thoughts, from one's mind, that the wrong understanding that you had a while ago, that it was a human being. And all that you need to do is to develop the correct perception or establish the non-human aspect of that effigy. And when that is established, the human aspect of human or that is a human, is that wrong perception that it's a human is totally removed.
Then I divided the money. I don't want to lose you, the Royal Putin. 아 누나 누나 모습이 좀 누나 같아서 여태 여아 지시시는 거. 어 먼저 와서 여아 지시시는 그게 뭐 아니다. 근데 지시한다.
In the same way, negative thoughts that we have are as wrong and as incorrect as the perception, as the wrong understanding that the attitude is a real human there, and therefore, negative. So, when we develop our understanding, correct understanding. Of the non-human nature of that attitude, so the misunderstanding that it's a human was removed because these are totally you know, opposed to each other. Two understandings are totally opposed to each other. So in the same way, although at the moment we have negative thoughts, which are wrong attitudes, and wrong thoughts, and as we develop positive attitudes, positive thoughts, and do positive things. So these negative thoughts and actions are affected directly and these get cleared away. The example given in this context is when, although at the moment there is overpowering cold, feelings of cold, but this cold won't cold contact or the cold, cold won't last long because when the heat comes into being, then this cold is affected directly by heat, and the cold is cleared away. In the same way, at the moment we may have many negative thoughts. When we develop proper antidotes mentally, then negative thoughts get directly affected by positive thoughts, because these are direct antidotes to each other. The way negative thoughts and positive thoughts affect each other is the same way as cold and heat affect each other, depending on the predominance of cold and heat. Therefore, if you have more positive thoughts, then negative thoughts can be overpowered. Like, suppose you have some hatred for someone else, and the moment your mind is filled with hatred for that person, at that time, you won't have love for the person. however, through changing circumstances, now you are, if you're filled, you have developed, you have removed animosity with that person or for that person, and when you're filled with love, then there's no room for hatred to crop up in your mind. There's only love. However, this love can again be affected by a moment of anger later on. So love and hatred are antidotes to each other. They affect each other. Therefore, what we need to do is we have to develop the strength of love and weaken the force of hatred. And in the same way, weaken the negative thoughts and to give, helping hand, as it were, to our positive thoughts. So with this talk now, we'll stop here for today, and we will practice our meditation, our single pointed meditation or concentration on the image of the Buddha. As I told you, it's very fortunate to be able to you know, establish connection with Buddha by way of this meditation. And as I've also told you that this house, in particular this room, is extremely holy place because of the presence of the image of the Buddha there and many paintings. It's just that we don't see, our ordinary eyes are too weak to see things beyond ordinary, things beyond our, things beyond their power. Otherwise, wherever there are statues of the Buddha, many Bodhisattvas, you know, come and make offerings to that statue or to that Buddha. It's just that we don't see. It's recorded in the scriptures in that way. Now, keeping these facts in mind, and I've also told you how to do meditation on the Buddha. So let's continue our practice on Buddha. So this house is really a Gaudiya, which is a very sacred place. Although there are many buildings and even more, you know, splendid buildings, but not all as sacred as this house is. Therefore, keeping these facts in mind, let's now continue our single-pointed, our practice of single-pointed concentration on the image of the Buddha. Many, as I told you earlier, many Buddhists go to Bodh Gaya, you know, in tens and in hundreds and thousands, or in hundreds every day. It's because, you know, Bodh Gaya is a place where Buddha attained enlightenment and where Buddha visited. If Bodh Gaya is to become a holy place on those grounds, so there's no reason why this house is cannot become, no, if not, or cannot become a holy place because of you know, the fully consecrated statue of Buddha is in this house. So now please continue the meditation. The present situation that we have is the most favorable situation, or the best kind of situation in which we can develop spiritually and thereafter really diminish and subsequently overcome all forms of miseries that humans experience. And, you know, but this present situation that we have, the most favorable one, won't last long, so we have to make, you know, we have to hasten and to, you know, speed up our practices to grow spiritually, because, you know, we are subject to various sufferings. If this human life that we have got now is not subject to aging, sickness, death, and other forms of suffering, then there would be no reason to pursue spiritual practices in order to achieve happiness and overcome sufferings. However, the reality is that human love is impermanent, therefore is subject to all this process of decay and change, aging, sickness and death. Now, in order to overcome this repeated cycle of birth and death, even if we are reborn as human beings for all times to come, yet we won't be, as human beings, we won't be free from these sufferings. All our future lives, even as human beings, will be subject to the 8 types of human suffering. So the best way to overcome these sufferings is to put an end to the birth itself as a human being and really grow spiritually and overcome these sufferings. Since time immemorial, beings have tried various external means to pursue happiness, but external means haven't been proven methods to develop happiness or to acquire happiness. Therefore, it's now realized that the only way to really secure lasting happiness, peace of mind, is to correct the mind itself, which is the agent of all forms of happiness and sufferings. Example in the certain continent is that the world in which we live is in a way very conducive to the growth of spiritual to the spiritual growth, because considering one's own misery and miseries and miserable life, it is quite easy to feel averse to the kind of miserable life that one lives and one will live, even as a human being in future lifetimes. And because of that, it is quite easy, considering one's own miseries, easy to develop a sincere yearning, a longing for total freedom, everlasting freedom from all from all one's human sufferings. And considering the sufferings of other human fellows and also other creatures, one is in a position to develop compassion for them, and thus develop a sense of compassion, which if one develops is an enlightening thought, a thought which will help one to achieve the state of enlightenment in order to liberate others also from their sufferings. When we practice offering of mandala, offering of in fact the 4 continents and the subcontinents as offering substances to the sublime beings, we talk about offering of the eastern continent, the southern continent that we live, this world, and then the western, northern continent, so on. it is said that in comparison to other continents, this world that we live is a very unfortunate world because it's full of sufferings and difficulties for the people or for the beings, and it's also called karmic world. Karmic world in the sense that if somebody were to perform serious negativity in his or her early life, then that it's very quick that the person can experience the consequences of that severe negative action or even positive action in the later part of life, So in other world systems, it takes lifetimes to experience results of actions performed in one lifetime. Now, in other continents, they are called continents of affluence, longevous governments, continents of affluence, especially the northern continent, where humans live definitely 1,000 years. There's no untimely death. Besides of immense affluence and prosperity, the beings there, humans there, don't have possessiveness. This is mine and this is yours. There isn't such a demarcation of self and others. Everything belongs to everybody, yet in great abundance. However, because they live such a happy, prosperous life, they get distracted in the enjoyment of affluence, material affluence, that they use up all merits earned through positive actions they had performed in the former lifetimes, and as a result, in their account of karma, what is only left is negativities that they had performed in former lifetimes. As a result, after their death, they always fall into miserable realms of existence. Although, as compared to that, this world is, as I told you before, really a difficult, suffering-ridden world. Yet, the sufferings themselves are very conducive for spiritually matured people to convert them as a means to further their spiritual development. It's because of this that enlightened beings, the Buddhas, come to this world, because of the sufferings that humans and other creatures undergo in this world, living in this world undergo, it's easier to tame them spiritually, to train them spiritually, and lead them along the paths to enlightenment. And now that we are humans of this world, and also knowing that we won't live as humans forever, therefore it would be quite worthwhile to make most of what we have, and without getting totally engrossed in pursuing short-lived happiness and the fame and reputation of this life. So we really better prepare ourselves for the future of our happiness. Just as the great Master Shantideva says, our plight is no different from sheep in the slaughterhouse. Sheep in the slaughterhouse, wherever they may try to run within the bounds of the slaughterhouse, in all directions the house is completely closed. It's a matter of time that it's a matter of time that they experienced death at the hand of butchers. In the same way, we are in a way, figuratively speaking, we are also in the slaughterhouse of Lord of Death, Death personified and then called Lord of Death. We are surrounded completely from the four cardinal directions by the Lord of Death. Wherever we may try to run, now we can never escape death, because of that death being, you know, inevitable, and also uncertainty of time of death, and also as to what we will become of in the future lifetimes. Because of that uncertainty, we have to ensure certain degree of certainty or definiteness in one's future happiness. Malarabha, the great Tibetan yogi practitioner, has said, what we call a frightening corpse is not there outside, it's there within one's own body. And the moment the breath stops, then our body, to which we are so attached, to which people relate friendly sometimes, and more friendly, so can become our most frightening corpse for them. So a frightening corpse is not outside, but within one's own body. Or one's own body is a frightening corpse. Another great Tibetan master says, we in a way are very hard-hearted people who are not moved by frightening things that take place around them. Maybe we are stupid as the sheep, when the sheep are taken to the slaughterhouse, and when the sheep are killed, the remaining ones don't get so much frightened, and they are ignorant of what they are going, what has happened to their friends and what will happen to them. So they are quite relaxed and easy going, even in the slaughterhouse. They have no sense of fright. And in the same way, he says, although many of our friends and people that we know and people we do not know are also dying day by day, yet we feel quite relaxed, as though we are not subject to death, as though we will remain happy in the people for all times to come. Therefore, it says, in a way, the fact that we are not moved and frightened in a way by constant deaths that take place in one's surrounding, it seems that we have grown very hard-hearted people. Even in this city, there are many cemeteries, and people who are buried in those cemeteries or graveyards, once were like us, living human beings, quite smart, rich, clever, but their wealth, their smart, smartness, or intelligence, whatever, they didn't have much, and they had to, and their wealth, so they died, and now they're buried there. So when we see cemeteries, so it should be a constant reminder that we should not be totally distracted by, things of this life.
Okay.
If we should be reminded by these things are for no practice, then how should we go about practicing and making this life meaningful? There was a time, you know, in the past when really dedicated practitioners spent their lifetimes in intensive practice, and as a result, have achieved greater realizations and even liberation and enlightenment. And now times have changed. We are passing through a completely different time, so we have to be realistic. Therefore, we can't renounce this life totally. However, without renouncing this world, we can do something virtuous. The best way to do is, you know, to integrate virtuous life, virtuous things in one's daily life. One of the ways is, when we wake up in the morning, we should always generate a very strong motivation to be virtuous, wholesome that day, and, you know, generate an altruistic motivation to be kind towards others, helpful towards others. And based on that motivation, if we, you know, if we try to refrain from negativities which we, if we were indulged in, if we were to perform, will bring suffering at the time of performing, and more important, severe, more, you know, as deadly sufferings in the future. So that's, you know, we should try to accomplish, incorporate virtuous deeds in our daily life, and to try as far as possible to refrain from negativities which is harmful to oneself and towards others. Even like stopping drinking and to smoking are the virtues. So if we stop these bad habits, and then, you know, after the stoppage of that these bad habits, so we cultivate the virtues out of these, and our life becomes more meaningful. I have already, you know, in great detail taught you how to develop single-pointed concentration on mental quiescence. Normally, when we meditate on the chosen object of meditation, or like a Buddha, we always do, we visualize Buddha in the space before one, ourselves, at the level of our forehead. However, when we practice shine, calm abiding of the mind on the object of concentration, so we visualize Buddha, the object of meditation, in one's front at one's navel level, and that's said to be a very conducive and easy and very convenient to visualize Buddha at such a, you know, level before one. So objects should be not too high, not too low. If the object meditation in practicing mental quiescence is too high, higher than self, then it is that as though one has to look up, and it in prolonged, sustained meditation, it tends to, you know, excite the mind and disturb concentration. If the object of meditation is lower than self, so it causes laxity of mind, or the dullness in meditation, or it causes dullness of meditation, therefore it's bad too. The best thing is to maintain the same level as self, as the meditator oneself, and then concentrate on the object. Like we have here a statue of the Buddha, it's the best thing is to look at the statue before we start meditation. Like normally we just have a careful observation or careful look at the statue, and then keep that memory of the statue, the image of the statue in one's mind, and let that image of the Buddha appear before one's mind's eye, and then concentrate on that. As I told you in the beginning, we won't have a clear meditation or clarity of clarity in one's meditation on the object. Then in the beginning we will only have a vague appearance of the object to one's mind's eye. One should be only too happy with that initially. As one goes on, clarity improves. It is to be able to meditate on the Buddha, it is said in the sutras that it's extremely beneficial. It's more beneficial for the self to meditate even for a short while on the Buddha than to give sumptuous foods to all beings in the world. It's said to be 16 times more beneficial. Now, if you could maintain a cross and vajra, cross-legged and position of lotus, position of legs and upright backbone, and so on, so maintaining the correct postures as far as possible, and please do this meditation.